On this week's 51%, we'll hear about a woman whose passion is ecotourism in China. Then we'll speak with an author with another passion, writing about unrequited love that she learned to let go.
What I say is I chose to focus on women not because they fall in unrequited love more often, not because they stalk more often. It's because we treat them more harshly when it comes to unrequited love, and we understand them less.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Leave your footprints, we'll shame them with our words. Gone people, all careless and consumed. Gone, gone, going, gone, everything. Gone, give a damn. Gone be the birds if they don't want to sing. Gone people, all awkward with their things. Gone.
Since Zhao Zhua founded the 54 Traveler Tourism Company with her husband, she's organized countless outdoor trips, always emphasizing responsible travel guidelines, like packing out trash and respect for local communities. She says she hopes the people who join her excursions will become invested in protecting China's environment. China's government has vowed to address environmental concerns after taking a growth-at-all-costs approach during the country's economic opening. Ruth Morris reports for Deutsche Welle in China.
For many Chinese, a holiday trip sounds like this. Bus tours shuttle people around to crowded water towns and gardens. Tourists follow a guide carrying a flag and a megaphone. But for those who sign up for a trip with 54 Traveler, that's the company Xiao Zhua founded with her husband, a holiday might sound like this. I'm joining Xiao Zhua and her husband on a day hike in the mountains to the west of Shanghai, near Hangzhou.
Yeah, from here, we should climb up 700 steps up. It's easy.
Xiao Zhua is 29, tall and athletic. She cares deeply about the environment. She packs her own chopsticks wherever she goes because she considers it wasteful to cut down trees for disposable ones. Her company offers outdoor trips to some of China's most remote and beautiful destinations. And there's something else that sets 54 Traveler apart. Its tiny footprint.
Do not leave anything but your footprint. Yeah. Take nothing but your picture. Yeah.
As we climb, we pass hikers of all ages. Some wear flip-flops, some wear bright, brand-name hiking gear. Sales of outdoor products in China have grown by almost 50% a year for the last decade. China's backpacking scene is taking off, but it's still a pretty recent phenomenon. When Xiao Zhua began exploring the outdoors 10 years ago, she'd mostly run into foreigners. She got started almost by accident.
At that time, I have a plan to do adventure, do a really adventure.
That's Glenn Fu. He was a fellow student at Xiao Zhua's university.
I'm passionate. I make some poster.
I saw a poster on the wall of Canton. It says it is the 15 years anniversary of the first human being who climbed to the peak of the Mount Everest. It says, I want to go to have a look of the Mount Everest.
I just say how dangerous it is and how amazing the things I will go to do.
I saw it and I see, oh, me too, I want to go.
But she called me.
I just called.
Xiao Zhua was the only one who called. On that first excursion, she was hospitalized twice, once for altitude sickness, another time for exhaustion. But she loved it. She and Glenn kept trekking through the mountains of Nepal and the grasslands of Mongolia. Along the way, they got married and started their company. It's growing so fast, they doubled their staff last year to 130 full and part-time employees. A couple hours into our hike, we come across a temple where monks are chanting. Xiao Zhua tells me that so many Chinese are traveling to their country's wild and remote places now that it actually worries her. The first time she went to Tibet, it seemed pristine. 8 years later, she went back, and it had changed.
Wow, it changed a lot. Yeah, mm-hmm. So many tourists. It's not so many. It's so many, so many, so many, so many, so many tourists.
Xiao Zhua wondered, are we part of the problem? She and Glenn began to incorporate Western guidelines for responsible travel into their trips. For example, before, they gave candy to children in remote villages. Then children began begging for the candy.
So when tourists come, they bring everything good and everything fancy. And they think their parents are not good, not rich. They love travelers. You educated them to begging.
Now 54 Traveler asks local temples and schools what they need instead, like school supplies or clothing.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, we have lunch here.
We reach a clearing over a terraced valley of green tea fields and old farmhouses with tiled roofs. Glenn says China's economic rise has made it possible for more and more people to explore new hobbies. Hiking and cycling are now fashionable. But he says there's another reason outdoor adventure is catching on.
People get rich, so they have the time and money. That's one reason. Second is people want to get more things for inspiration for their mind.
Inspiration for their mind. After 3 decades in economic overdrive, Glenn says, people are searching for something deeper. He himself just got off a 10-day meditation program, spent in absolute silence. We head down the hill. A monk passes in the other direction. He's wearing a t-shirt with Chinese characters. It says, "See through, let go." Xiaozhua says she doesn't aspire to change the world, but she does hope the Chinese tourists who sign up for her trips become invested in protecting the places they visit.
I can change the world, but I can change myself and from my company. Yeah, try to do something good. I don't want to complain about the country or complain about the society. You can build a new person. Yeah, you can build a new you.
And perhaps that's just how big societal changes get started. This is Ruth Morris for DW in Hangzhou.
The summer Lisa Phillips turned 30, she fell in love with someone who did not return her feelings. She soon became obsessed. She followed him around, called him compulsively, and talked about him endlessly. One morning, after she snuck into his apartment building, he picked up a baseball bat to protect himself and threatened to dial 911. Her unrequited love had changed her from a sane college teacher and radio reporter into someone she barely recognized, someone who had taken her yearning much too far. Phillips, formerly a reporter with WAMC Northeast Public Radio and currently a journalism professor at the State University of New York at New Paltz, in her new book, Unrequited, Women and Romantic Obsession, interweaves her own story with interviews and research in science, psychology, cultural history, and literature. 51%'s Joe Donahue asks Phillips for how long the book had been in her.
A really long time. I would say the first words that I wrote that remain in the book today were actually written very shortly after I left working full-time at WAMC. I went off to a writer's colony in Wyoming and started writing about this thing that happened to me in 1998, the year I turned 30. And then I put it down and did all the things you said, had a kid, wrote another book, and then I picked it up again. And then I put it down again and about 6 years ago started working on it in earnest.
So the thing that happened to you is that you realized, and I'll allow you to tell the story, but you realized that through a rather sobering event, the love that you had for an individual was not being returned.
Yeah, I'll tell the story, the basics of the story. The year I turned 30, I started spending time with someone I knew from graduate school, and there was lots of nice chemistry. We had fun together. He had a girlfriend that was fine with me. I had just gotten out of another relationship, but it seemed very clear that we were headed towards something. And when that didn't happen, I became very frustrated. I lost my patience. I lost that sense of fun. And I became also obsessed, really obsessed with this person, and thought about him a lot, couldn't focus on anything else. And at one point, these feelings led me to really very ardently pursue him to the point of sneaking into his apartment building, knocking on his door until he opened it, holding a baseball bat and dialing 911 to call the cops.
And that's the moment that snapped with you?
I'd like to say that was the moment that snapped. It's more complicated than that, and I tell this in parts in the book. Actually, we ended up strangely spending the day together. But that moment was very shocking because I had thought, I'm making this grand, bold gesture to show this person how much I love him. And he reacted so differently that I was really disarmed. But I still didn't quite, it didn't shake me out of it. It took a few weeks later when he said to me, "We can never speak again." Those words were very key. I was ready to hear them, and that was it.
When you decided to look at this, and one of the things that I found fascinating about the book is this notion of obsession. And to me, obsession is one of those words that we often throw around without really knowing its true meaning and what that means to be obsessed by something. And we'll say, oh, you know, I watch House of Cards and it's an obsession. But what you are talking about is almost a clinical definition of being obsessed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I loved Downton Abbey. I was obsessed with serial in the common parlance. And that's what's been so interesting is in the time I've been writing this book, the word has become so common in our parlance. And it's true that there's a huge difference between looking forward to the next episode of Serial so much that you can't wait to download it and being so caught up in something that you literally can't think of anything else. There's been brain scan research on people just after a breakup, and they'll say that more than 90% of the time, if they're still in love with the person, they're thinking about the person. That's a lot of time. So that's very much what I was going through.
And what you write about, too, which I think is one of the most interesting notions, is that that obsession is often more romantic than if the love that you have was reciprocated.
Yeah. And just to clarify, I mean, certainly at the point where I started really chasing him and crossing the line into stalking, that's not romantic, right? That's aggressive. That's self-centered. That's narcissistic. Right. That's wrong. But it's true that when you are in unrequited love in the beginning, which characterizes a lot of people before they actually get into a relationship, they don't know if the person loves them back. You're living with a question and you're living with a fantasy and you're living with ideals wrapped around someone. And that can be a lot of fun because there's no reality yet. You know, it's very imaginative. It's very creative. You're thinking about your future. And you're living in this very suspenseful story that you're in the center of. And so that part of it doesn't always segue into something worse or stalkery. In fact, it often doesn't. But usually something happens. Either you get together with the person or you don't, and you have to reckon with that. But that particular time can be an exciting, inspiring, very romantic time.
Once you identified it, and once you were able to come to grips with what had happened, and obviously time takes care of some of this. You get married, you have a child. When you look back, do you see seeds of that behavior in earlier relationships?
Well, you know, if there are any of my ex-boyfriends out there listening, they'll be like, yeah, I remember. No, I'm joking mostly. But yeah, I think there were certain relationships that triggered a lot of hope in me. And I felt a version of that obsessiveness. I wasn't always that way. I wasn't always needy. Oftentimes, I could be quite confident and very much myself in a relationship, but there were certain relationships stretching back to when I was a kid, when I was 14 and fell in love with a guy from camp, where I really became very preoccupied and the stakes seemed very, very high.
I ask the question because it separates how much of it is on you and how much of it is on you and the relationship with the other person. In other words, what role the other person has, what they're triggering in you.
So this is a really interesting question because some of the women I interview for the book, and there are a lot of stories of women who have been in unrequited love, and also of men and women who have been the targets of unrequited love. Some of them are serial unrequited lovers and serial obsessors. This is their MO. This is all they do. And what psychology says about this is usually there's some kind of what they call problem of attachment, that's very likely that something in their earliest experiences of caregiving wasn't secure enough. And so that they're going to be always anxious and needy in relationships. And with other people, it was a one-time kind of thing. And I think for me, the vividness of it, it really was a one kind of thing. And so you say, okay, well, where does that come from? And I think a big part of what happens when unrequited love becomes so entrenched is that you fix an idea or a goal that's really important to you. Often it's the classic goal of a life partner, marriage and a family. And you can't unhook that goal from the person. The two become inextricable, though obviously we can love more than just one person. It's not like that for real, and it's especially not like that if the person doesn't love you back. Right. That person isn't getting you closer to the goal.
If you were at the time to have filled out a questionnaire and there was a question that said, are you a stalker? And there was a box of yes or no, I assume you would check no.
I would have checked no.
But anyone else looking at your behavior and the way you were reacting to the situation probably would have put you in the yes column.
That's what's really interesting. Some people may have. But I think much of what I did kind of went under what I call a gender pass, mm-hmm. where when women act this way, often we may call her a stalker, but we'll kind of joke about it and be like, oh, look at her. She wants to boil the bunny and all those ha-ha funny things. And I think if I were male, I don't know if I would have put myself in that category because people can be very deluded in this state. But I think everybody else in my life who knew about it would have said, yeah, you know, he's gone way overboard. He's stalking her. This is wrong. This is abusive. And they would have been very clear about my behavior. So I think it took me a while to put a label, a very long time to put a label on this.
And you talk a lot about gender in the book in the sense of the issue is the issue and it happens regardless of gender. And yet we look at it very differently.
Exactly. What I say is I chose to focus on women not because they fall in unrequited love more often, not because they stalk more often. It's because we treat them more harshly when it comes to unrequited love and we understand them less. And what I mean by that is we'll tend to mock and belittle a woman who gets hung up on someone who doesn't reciprocate because she's wasting her time, you know, her fertile years. And then when she does go overboard, there's that, again, that sort of mocking of this isn't really real. And wouldn't a guy actually like a woman to really stalk him and go after him and make herself sexually available? We don't take it very seriously. So I felt those things needed to be unpacked and clarified in an empathic way, in a way that helps us understand the phenomenon of women and unrequited love, both in its good ends and its bad ends, better.
I'm borderline on gossiping here, but
sure.
But at what point did you bring this up to your future husband?
Well, it's funny because I met him not at all long after the day the man I call B in the book told mm-hmm. me that we could never speak again. It was literally, you know, within a month. And at that point, I just so badly wanted to be a normal woman.
Right.
And I think I mentioned it to him fairly soon, but kind of more in the terms of, oh, this was something I wanted to happen and it didn't and it was hard on me. And then I think the conversation was very gradual over time. And then I think when I wrote the essay for Modern Love that was published in 2006, yeah. That's when he could see it all narrativized. I could see it all narrativized and put together. And I think that wasn't where he found out about it, but where he saw how I was seeing it in the landscape of my past.
Put it into a context. And into a context of your relationship, because obviously you are different than that with him and after these years.
Thank goodness, right? He'd be a very miserable man the past 13 years. No, my husband, Bill Mead, he's an artist and he's a wonderful man. And I think one of the reasons people will say, and I think you're kind of maybe dancing around this, like, so is your husband okay with all this stuff you're saying about your past? And he has always been abundantly supportive. And we joke that part of the reason is he's the prince at the end of the story, right? Because through him, I could see that, yes, I could do this right. I could find someone who would treat me well and I would treat him well in return.
Well, to me, it was a sign of the strength of a relationship that you have the trust to be able to not only talk about an issue like that, but to know it exists and to understand each other in the most open of ways.
Yeah, I agree. This has never been a point of contention with us that I was open about this story.
So what do we learn? I mean, this is in many ways, this is a story as old as time, right? So this is something that certainly isn't going to go away. But what can we learn from reading your story and from reading the stories of the other women that you talk about and talk to in the book?
I think there's a lot of learning just to come from the variety of stories. Some of them are stories of creative inspiration and personal change, really wonderful, inspiring stories. A lot of the stories are much darker than that, of course, of people either being self-destructive or pursuing to a more aggressive degree. I think that the takeaways here also come from the last chapter where I talk about letting go and how you do that. And the one thing I want to say, because you just had me talking about my husband and my marriage, is that that's not necessarily going to be the answer for everybody, that they're going to run into their future spouse, you know, weeks after an obsession ends. But I think that finding love in its many forms is very, very important, because you're in a deficit when you've been rejected. You're hungry for it. There's a whole drive that is biologically ingrained in us that is not being satisfied. And so when you can really enrich your social ties and rely on the ones you have already that are strong, whether that be from family or close friends or other people in the workplace, sometimes even are the people you lean on, that is really important. That's not like a frivolous thing. And I think in this age where we spend a lot of time, you know, staring at our phones and feeling like we can exist for days without seeing people because of the internet, we are really in this danger of being very alone and forgetting about those social ties or neglecting them. So that's very important. And then a couple of other things I would say is, this is something people hate to hear, but if you are obsessed with someone and it's interfering with your life, you've got to cut him or her off. There's just really no other way around it. I was lucky he cut me off. A lot of times the person who's obsessed has to find the strength to do that. No letters, no looking at the Facebook page, no phone calls, no meeting for coffee, no let's be friends. You can't do any of that. And oftentimes you need to seek help for that. There's some very good therapeutic techniques out there. The one I will mention, if you're looking for a therapist, is to look for someone with training in cognitive behavioral therapy, which has very specific skills to help you redirect your brain away from the thing you're obsessed with. And then I also think, finally, a very key thing to letting go is to really ask yourself that question, what does that person mean to you? And can you cope with that thing that means, and seeking that instead of fixating it on the person? What goals are you associating with the person? Well, if you want love and marriage, say, just the most classic of goals, that's a very valid thing to pursue. We shouldn't be ashamed of it. I think I was ashamed of wanting those things. But it's not going to come from that person you're fixated on. It's going to come from just, you know, living in the world and dealing with the, you know, the vicissitudes of finding love. But if you're on the wrong path, that will not help you.
You refer to the man in the book as B, as you mentioned. Do you send him a copy of the book?
Does he get a copy? You know, I made a decision. We did see each other again. I ran into him in the city where this all took place. And it was a nice conversation. We were both in a very good place, and we talked very civilly, and there was a sense of closure and some admission of what had happened. And it was very clear to me that that had to be it. But occasionally writing the book, I grappled with, well, should I try to do a scene where I go out to where he lives and ask him about what his experience of this? And I just thought, no, that's not right, because then it's still all about me and what I need from him. And I need to send a very strong message that you turn it back toward yourself. You reckon with yourself. You let the other person live their life. However, one thing I did do was I talked to men who had been targets of women like me. And I got their experiences, which was really moving and really insightful. I got to sort of see the other side of it through, you know, somebody I didn't have an emotional investment in.
That was Lisa Phillips, author of Unrequited, Women and Romantic Obsession, speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1338.